students, and then I do biogeochemistry courses for graduate students. And mostly what I do is river biogeochemistry, which I guess it's sort of, I'm not satisfied doing any one thing, so I get a little bit of biology, geology, chemistry, the whole works. And rivers in particular are kind of cool because they integrate entire watersheds, entire catchments. And so what we've been working with lately is trying to this concept that what you measure at the mouth is an integrated signal of everything that happens upstream. And so we're interested in using that as an indicator of climate change and land use change, things like that. And so that's the pure science side of it for me. From a more practical standpoint, most people would call that water chemistry, water quality. And so that's kind of my tie over into the more water quality angle of things. This particular topic that we're talking today about is what the popular media doesn't tell you about water quality. And it's not a conspiracy thing here. As much as anything else, I think it's just a reflection of the fact that as a scientist, I like my stuff to be accurately represented. And I want the not the right message to get out, but I just want it to be accurate. And I think that's one of the things that as scientists we all struggle with how our work is portrayed in the popular media. It's very easy for it to get politicized. It's very easy for agendas to be for there to be agendas when it comes to water quality. But it's also very easy just for the people who are doing the writing or the TV productions just to not really get it, not really understand what's going on. And I'm just curious if you got any idea, any examples of water quality in the popular media that you can give me here in recent years, or not such recent years. It could be movies or TV shows or what you've heard on the news. Anything like that pop into mind here? When's the last time you've encountered any kind of water quality issue in the media?
Yeah. All the radiation from Fukushima in the water.
Okay.
So it's a huge deal in Hawaii.
So radiation, this is from Japan over to Hawaii.
And California, but more about it in Hawaii because it's a bit.
So what do you get? What kind of information do you get from them? What do they tell you and what don't they tell you? And is it mostly just a scare factor?
Scare factor, mm-hmm. Yeah. That they're testing the water levels and they're finding immense amounts of radiation, like 300 times the acceptable amount and things like that. So mm-hmm.
And this is new simply from
Fukushima the tidal wave.
And so what's done about it? I mean, anything else?
Nothing. Yeah. Nothing. They just tell you there's no way to protect yourself from it, apparently.
Except lots of iodine,
so,
maybe.
Well, there's, I mean, that's the thing, is that all, from the health food store perspective, mm-hmm. all of the iodine was off the shelves, and they couldn't keep it stocked. Mm-hmm. And then lots of people were talking about eating seaweed and things like that, but the media doesn't tell you that. That's all the, like, health foodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other examples, things that you've heard, water quality, you have one?
BP, just the BP oil spill, all of that stuff.
Yeah. So, BP, so you're talking about the Gulf, or?
Yeah.
Okay, and
the
oil
spill.
So you also have Exxon
Delta
in Montana, right?
Yeah.
And Yellowstone River.
Yeah.
The tar sands of Alberta.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
In Minnesota, we're always getting information about the snail, zebra snails getting carried from lake to lake, and then also, what's the plant that
milfoil
stuff that, destroying the lakes,
and also the
mercury,
the sedimentation, the farmers' practices that are letting so much soil run to the
river,
to the water,
or is erosion
fill up Lake Pepin with mud,
and then the dead zone at the end of the Mississippi.
Okay.
The Delta.
Gulf.
You forgot the MISS,
I know.
We all know
the
abbreviated.
Just the. Sing a song here.
Golf or Mexico. top of Mexico dead zone.
On a really small scale, you know, in our city of Minnetonka, a suburb of Minneapolis, they always publish once a year water quality study where they give you their count on the levels of arsenic and other minerals in the water and what's an acceptable range and make comments when anything's out of an acceptable range. So.
Yeah, and that comes out in the popular media, or that's just your utility that sends that out to you?
The city of Minnetonka sends it out in a publication to all the residents.
Right, okay. Well, that's pretty good that you're actually paying attention to those. I mean, they send one of
those. I knew I was coming to this class. So.
They send those out in Davis as well. It's just kind of interesting to pick through. I mean, we've got some issues with arsenic also. Yeah.
Down in Texas, where my family lives, I grew up, it's the Barnett Shale, where they're doing a lot of fracking to get it natural gas.
Mm-hmm. Is there a K in fracking?
I think it's two K's, but I'm not entirely sure. I don't think it matters for the sake of this class.
Well, you know, I've just been, you know, we don't talk about fracking out in California much, but I've been getting that story here in the Midwest or in the middle of the country. So, yeah.
Leave no stone unturned.
What is fracking?
In order to get at the natural gas deposits in the Barnett Shale, which is now smack dab under a heavily populated metropolitan area, they have to inject huge amounts of salt water laced with chemicals. The chemicals themselves are proprietary, nobody actually knows what's in them. So they, in order to break up the shale to get at the natural gas, you have to inject under high pressure, huge quantities of chemical-laced water in order to pump up the natural gas.
Don't they, there's use sand for that too, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're talking about shipping sand from Minnesota to Texas.
The whole process is proprietary. The EPA, in their inexorable slowness, is slowly coming around to dealing with it. But you know what they've learned a long time ago is that you tie it up in courts for decades while the process is still going on. By the time the court process winds itself down, you've already gotten the natural gas out of there and left behind, you know, benzene in the air and any number of things in the groundwater.
So that would all come under the class of emerging contaminants, stuff that, you know, pollutants that we don't even know about yet that are still online. Pharmaceuticals are in the class of things like that, emerging contaminants that we just really don't understand the whole impact of them. Flame retardants are another one of those things, you know, the byproducts of making Teflon and fluorinated coatings. That's another one that's sort of in that list of emerging contaminants so this fracking stuff, I guess, is going to fall under that too. And yeah, it's hard for the EPA to keep up with all the chemicals that can be produced. Any of you seen the movie Erin Brockovich?
Yes.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that one?
People getting sick.
Brockovich. Were you convinced? I mean, did you feel like it was accurately portrayed and that it was all real? And How many people here? Just raise your hands. How many people have actually seen Erin Brockovich? Okay. You know, it's one of those movies that where there's such a strong emotional appeal, and they worked it really hard. And you know, what's frustrating is the science. It turns out that pretty much all the science in there was crap, and it's like it's not even real. There probably was hexavalent chromium in the water. It's probable that it didn't cause any of the things that were portrayed in the movie. It's just the science is not there to back it up. And so, you know, it's an example of a movie where you know, they can make a very strong emotional appeal. I think that's one of the interesting things about the media is how loosely they can play, you know, the facts can be played with and how strongly you can work on people's emotions when it comes to water quality. You got a comment?
A question for somebody who has not seen the movie.
Sure.
Was the portrayal of the court case in the movie accurate to the real court case?
I think so. Reasonably accurate, the court case was. I mean, there was not very much in there.
So are you then kind of disagreeing with the science that they used as the basis of bringing the case to court?
Even that was kind of loosey-goosey, but there was the particular movie is kind of like trial by what's popular opinion, trial by innuendo, and so there's a lot of innuendo in the movie that just turns out not to be true. I mean, you know, there's no scientific data that shows that links hexavalent chromium to any kind of diseases when you ingest it. It's like there's a, you know, one of the ways that you try to get information about contaminants and what it does to the populations is that, you know, you can't ask people to willingly subject themselves to hexavalent chromium ingestion just to see what happens. But you can go to places where they were accidentally exposed to it and look for increases in the population in diseases that happen within the population. And so there's a particularly spot in near Glasgow where there was hexavalent chromium that was leaked into the groundwater, just huge amounts. And so you could measure it in the people's urine. It was just, you know, massive exposure to this stuff. And when you do the population statistics on it, there was no statistical increase in any of the supposed diseases that you would that they were attributing to it in the movie Aaron Brockovich. I mean, it just, you know, it was there, but it wasn't causing any problems. It does cause problems when you inhale it. And so one of the ironies of the whole movie is, or of that whole situation afterwards, is that the actual real live Aaron Brockovich actually did end up getting cancer of the nasal septa from being in and around these environments and breathing it in as an aerosol. In that, you know, there's misting plants where the water will come out, where you can breathe it in, or if you get dust that's blowing, you can breathe it in. So it is an accepted. Hexavalent chromium is demonstrated to cause cancer when it's inhaled, but not when it's ingested. And so, you know, but the whole movie was based on the idea that this stuff was being ingested and causing all sorts of weird, of different kinds of diseases, and it just doesn't work. And so that's an example of on a large scale of how water quality gets misportrayed in the media. My sister was giving me an example in Minot, North Dakota here, where she said that the turbidity levels were high and they were encouraged to boil the water. Well, turbidity has nothing to do with boiling water. I mean, if it's turbidity, you would filter it. And if it's a concern at all, I mean, what you would boil the water for is pathogens, not for turbidity. And so with that kind of information that gets floating around, it's frustrating to have that kind of misinformation that's spread around. And I think that's, you know, as a general population, that's where we get our information from, is the media. And so when it's not portrayed accurately, it's, you know, the things can get spun out of control. So anyway, today, I guess what I wanted to go through is something I go through in the first day of my water quality class, and just kind of giving sort of a four-point framework for how we look at water quality stuff. And in my class, I have them read newspaper articles and sort of interpret them within this framework. And you know, I'll ask them for specifically what's missing, what kind of information is missing. So the first thing that I want to do is just have you guys get into groups of three or four, and I want you to come up with a definition of water quality for me. So that's your first Okay, can I ask if any group here has a very precise definition for water quality right now?
Yes.
Sure.
Okay.
No, you go ahead.
It's precise.
It had to do with safety and life supporting. Is that how you phrase it? Safety for humans and drinking, but also water that is life supporting.
No pathogens in it.
Except for pathogens. Life supporting except for pathogens.
No pathogens in it.
Except for. What? Let's see. So, what is life supporting?
And sustaining?
Bad life. Anything else you want to stick on?
How do you like that one?
But there are
failing on the precise part.
There are some things that are good. If you grew up in North northern South Dakota, there's natural fluorine in the water, and that's good for the teeth. That's some of those kind of things are good for your water, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. So what kind of definition were you cycling around?
Good taste.
Good taste?
That's number one.
Add a check mark from our
are,
group, too. We
what's that?
Put two specific good taste,
yeah,
too.
Good taste.
That was part of it.
But that's a relative thing, because people in northern South Dakota like the taste of their horrible water.
Aberdeen's not good.
How about you? What kind of definition did you come up with?
We got close to the source, accessible, most natural state, harmful substances at tolerable level.
Oh, good.
Close to source.
And that what that meant was, you know, our perception is that water has higher quality if it's coming off the mountain,
uh-huh,
or coming right off the glacier. We don't know if that's true, but our instinct was to say that,
uh-huh,
get to its source, that's probably
before the deer.
Except for the Giardia, except for the Giardia problem.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. So what else did you have on your list?
Accessible.
Okay. Spell better when I type.
Most natural state.
I guess I'm curious what you consider to be natural.
Well, that was one of the things we talked about. Saying, okay, what, you know, it could be poison, and
uh-huh,
be poison to me.
Yeah.
And be in its natural state.
Yeah. How about you guys?
Like Four Rivers and Eden.
Yeah.
And the last one was harmful substances at
a tolerable level.
Oh, harmful.
Substance.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Tolerable. Okay, how about this back group? What did you?
Well, to kind of piggyback on that last one, we looked at it from an EPA standpoint of,
mm-hmm,
defining harmful substances in parts per million,
mm-hmm,
and what, you know,
at acceptable levels.
Right.
Okay, so you're looking a little bit towards something that would be quality standards.
Yeah, I was kind of shooting at like physical, chemical, and biological characteristics of water that are acceptable for human use, or I don't know how we go beyond that to other organisms.
Well, we can. How about you? What did you come up with?
We just kind of struggled.
Talked about the rain and how it's doing with the crops.
How about drinkable, not chewable?
Yeah, that's
okay.
We struggled with, you know, just how many different types of water there are. There's groundwater, rivers, lakes,
yeah,
and oceans. They all have their own different issues and different things that make them contaminants. Then there's naturally occurring things that may make the water not drinkable or not safe for a lot of people. And does that contribute to water quality, or doesn't it? And so we're kind of kicking around those things for
What if I had said something like this: defined relative to swimmers. Would you have had an easier time defining water quality if I had said just, you know, in relative to swimmers?
No,
what does water quality mean for swimmers?
Temperature.
Temperatures, pathogens,
parasites,
maybe, you know, different things. But if you limit it to swimmers here, I think you can get to a better answer. What if I do relative to drinkers? Yeah. Then we can focus on just the human health aspects of it, and there's a certain level of concentrations that work for human health, and you can develop a whole set of water quality standards that work for drinkers. What if I say relative to agriculture?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can get away with more salts in agricultural uses, and you can get a lot away with a lot of other different kinds of things with in the water that you know. This maybe is a little bit more lenient than this is. This is maybe a little bit more lenient than this is.
Laundry is an issue in Western North Dakota farms with rusty well water.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So the point here is that you really can't get a good definition of this until you figure out who the stakeholders are. Who are the stakeholders, and what are the beneficial uses? And so that's kind of the key thing to home in on whenever you know in any kind of water quality issue is you need to know these things. Who are the stakeholders? What are the beneficial uses? And so that's the first thing that you really have to home in on to kind of understand or get a better grasp on what the water quality issues are and how it's being perpetrated and what it's relative to. Because, you know, sediments in the water, you know, that doesn't really matter for agriculture. It just doesn't. You know, you put it out in the field, the plants don't care if there's sediment in there, but it does matter for drinkers. And so to really get a good handle on the water quality and what water quality is, you need to pick these two things out there. So that's like the first question I'll ask somebody when they're reading an article in my class is, you know, who are the stakeholders? Identify this stuff there. Then that gives you a basis for trying to understand the rest of the topic. Okay, so let's go with another hypothetical situation here. Let's say you get one of these water quality reports from your utility, and they tell you that you've got TCE in it. What do you want to know?
What's TCE?
Okay, so TCE, trichloroethylene. What else do you want to know?
What is it? How does it occur? What is its risk?
So you want to know sources. Let's start with some sources. It's a solvent. So machining, dry cleaning. Any kind of, almost any industry might give this stuff out. There's a huge, the Aerojet. Aerojet is a place that makes rocket fuel near Rancho Cordova, near Sacramento, and they had a huge TCE plume that they had to clean up. What's that?
Wasn't that in Utah?
Well, it's all over the place, but this particular one was in Rancho Cordova, and there's kind of a sad tale about that whole thing, but I won't go into that. Anyway, so that's what it is. It's usually some sort of an industry thing, business kind of thing. It's a solid. What else do you want to know?
How much of it was in the water? I mean,
okay. How much?
I'm combing my emotional hair as I hear this, you know, solid. Then I think, wow, that sounds bad. Oh. So if it sounds, so then responding to that emotional reaction, then I want to know what impacts does it have on humans and the environment as a whole, and what level is ingesting it safe.
Okay, so.
Because I can know how much is in the water, but that doesn't give me a frame of reference for what's considered tolerable. Or.
And that adjusts you.
Right.
Okay. We know it's financially good, right? So you want to be solvent.
That's right. So let's just say what's in the water, 10 parts per billion. Are you happy with that now?
Probably not.
I don't have a frame of reference.
Okay, so you need some sort of frame of reference on this as well. And so there's terminology, maximum contamination.
And then once I know that, I want to know who determined that amount.
And that's an MCL, or that's the common abbreviation for this. So the MCL for this one is 5 parts per billion. So are you safe? Are you happy? Are you not happy?
You're not happy.
So you trust this number implicitly, and you're not at all curious to where this comes from and what it means.
I want to know who developed the number and what the What's around that number?
Okay, so
tell this a story around that number.
So this typical number, there's a few different ways that number can come from. One of them is like with the hexavalent chromium, is if there's been natural exposure to it. So they'll take like TCE. It's used so commonly in so many industrial things that they'll find people who have worked in these plants, people who have been exposed to it. And so they'll do some sort of population studies like that to find out if there's been any increase. Risk of chronic diseases or this particular one, liver cancer, is something that you're susceptible to from TCE. Hodgkin's disease, non-lymphoma, Hodgkin's disease, leukemia. Those are a couple of the other diseases that are commonly associated with TCE in this class of solvents. Since it's a solvent, I mean, it will dissolve fats. So if you can imagine, if you've got any fat in your body, you can imagine many different ways that this kind of a solvent could interact with the tissues in your body. So that's one of the things, you know, when you think about how exposure to the different chemicals, I mean, like dissolves like interacts with like. So, you know, one of the problems with heavy metals is that they frequently swap out with calcium in your bones because they kind of have the same type of chemistry. Arsenic is similar to sulfur, so it will swap out with sulfur compounds in your body and cause problems. So there's different kinds of things. So this one interacts with fats in your body, but it causes cancers.
Can solvents be filtered, or is that a solvent can't be filtered?
With a charcoal filter, you can get it. You can't filter it out with, not just a size one, but with a charcoal filter, you can get it out. So anyway, they'll do that kind of thing. They'll look for population exposure. They can also do studies with rats and mice and other kinds of animals, and they'll try to figure out on a per mass basis, like how much per mass of rat causes problems, and then they'll come up with some ways to extrapolate. So the typical thing that they'll do for that is they'll take a concentration like this. They'll assume that the average person drinks 2 liters of water, so that will tell you how much you're getting exposed to per day, and then they'll scale that according to these rat studies to decide what this level is. This level here has typically got a safety factor of 100 or 300 built into it, and so they'll take whatever value they get from these people studies or from these rat studies, and they'll multiply that times either 100 or a 300 to account for sensitive groups and uncertainty factors and things like that. So even though this value here is at 5, in theory, if you're not in a sensitive group, 10 parts per billion probably wouldn't be a big deal for you. I mean, they're still going to act on it because this is the legal limit that's been set. But realistically, you could probably be okay with that as long as you're not in one of the sensitive groups. Yeah?
I want to know who did the studies. Did the manufacturers of the TCE do the studies, or did someone else do the studies?
For these things to come through, I think they're usually associated with the EPA. The EPA has got to have the final call on those. Yeah.
Because if it was the manufacturers, of course, then I don't trust those numbers very much.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so, I mean, we've kind of answered a little bit of this. We've answered what does it do to humans. Any other kind of questions that you want to know?
How long will it be here?
Okay, so...
Is it a plume that will, go through in a week, or is it in the aquifer for decades to come?
Okay, so it's... Let's see, how's the best way to put that? Natural attenuation, I guess, would be.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the MCLs, are they intrachronic?
Are
the effects from TCE, are they something that, like, you drink one glass and those happen, or is more a matter of being exposed for a period of 10 years?
It's a chronic exposure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And normally, are those studies, do they have a longitudinal perspective? 40 or 50 years, or is it?
Well, I mean, in rats, no, you don't get rats living 40 or 50 years. So it's just till they get their thing. I mean, in people, yeah, I don't know. Like in people exposure to this, the classic case here is in Woburn, Massachusetts. There's a movie called Civil Action that was based on an exposure to things like TCE, PCE, several different chlorinated solvents, and that they started using these two wells in kind of this coulee that were surrounded by a tannery and by a dry cleaning place and by some other kind of industrial machining place, and all of those were leaking these kinds of solvents into the water, and there was an extremely elevated level of cases of leukemia in kids. And so, I mean, the kids were, these were kids who were like, 10 years old. So I mean, longitudinal study, I don't know how to answer that too, but that's how quickly I guess it can happen. But it's a complicated thing, because with anything like this, you know, legally they'll come back and just say, well, it could have been any of these things. How could you prove that it's specifically TCE that caused this? So it's a very tricky one to kind of track down.
I'm just add, what is the impact does it have on whatever's living in the water?
Okay, so ecological impact. Okay, we could keep going with this, but a lot of these questions come down to things that have to be answered by science. And so this is where the science comes in. So you have to identify who the stakeholders are. Then you bring in the science into it. There's other aspects of the science as well. It's like, how do you clean this stuff up? That would be something that would come from science. How much does it cost? That's something that would come from science. So the science is kind of the second plank that you're looking for. For me, I'm looking for numbers. You don't find numbers in newspaper articles very much in the media. They rarely give you this number. They rarely give you this kind of number. I'm always begging my students to give me numbers in any kind of papers they write for me, and it's just not a very intuitive thing for most people to do numbers, but I want to know how elevated the actual concentration is relative to this. Until you give me that piece of information, I feel pretty lost in looking at these kinds of articles, and it's just not there. Okay, let me give you another kind of hypothetical situation, or I guess it's not hypothetical, but...
So another actual
So science, so this is for back in your groups again. So the way the EPA works is that they have regional, I mean the EPA is divided up, I think it's into 9 regions, and within these 9 regions they have something called local, or regional, I guess we'll call them regional, water quality control boards. And this is really where all the action happens. This is where all the regulation happens, more on a local level. I mean, the EPA is the big umbrella organization, but it happens to these. So I would like you to imagine that you've just been appointed as the head of one of these regional water quality control boards, and a cheese factory has already been approved for being constructed within your jurisdiction. I want you to kind of imagine what kind of policy that you would put in place, what kind of regulation you would put in place. You know, put yourself as a policy person and figure out how are you going to manage this cheese factory that's going in and make sure that everything is okay. That's your job right now. So back in your discussion.
What kind of cheese?
Tell them what kind of cheese.
Well, down in our neck of the woods, it's the Hillmar cheese factory that's doing it.
And there's no cows involved, right? The factory's just getting...
Yeah, you don't need to worry about the cows part. You can just worry about the factory itself.
The EM was going down the drain.
Some ideas for me now? Why don't I start over here? These guys finished first, so I'll let them talk first.
Yeah.
Well, we basically talked about inputs and outputs, what it's going to draw from the local area, like will it use groundwater, how will that affect people? Basic outputs, what kind of air pollution will it put out, what kind of, will it dump into the river system?
Okay, so you're asking some science questions. So as a policymaker, what are you going to do?
Set standards.
So you're going to set standards for what?
Water quality.
Water use. Water use. Isn't that what we're talking about?
Anybody else want to chime in on that one? Yeah.
We're going to hire you to come.
Okay.
Help us. Cool. Yeah. We talked about inputs and outputs, and then both the information that the cheese factory would provide to us, as well as what we would want to test for, or find out ourselves. And then we thought of connecting with a community somewhere else that has had a cheese factory and trying to find out what sorts of experiences they might have had, what kind of questions we might be missing.
Okay, so
and then how much free cheese do we get if we go with standards?
My friend,
what is an appropriate bribe for looking at
that? Yeah. Well, so you're going to get a budget. I mean, as a regional thing, you'll have a certain budget, and you're going to have to decide how you want to do your budget. And one of the things you can spend your budget on as the head of this local or regional water quality control board is to get science stuff. I mean, that'll be one of the things that you can do if you want to get answered. Or another way you can do it is you can make the factory. Funding, yeah.
By the time it gets to the regional water quality control board, it's gone through an environmental assessment and any number of other
right
studies.
Yeah, the environmental impact stuff. Yeah. Yeah, it would be a point source, so it would be, yeah, that's an important thing. It's a point source.
And then also how large a
So therefore, body. It has to meet specific water quality standards, because that's what the Clean Water Act says it has to do.
And then also the size of the body of water that the effluent will be going into.
Mm-hmm. And why does that matter?
As
dilution.
Right. As was pointed out in a very pithy way, dilution is the solution to pollution. And then also from a policy perspective, what is that body of water? Is it for recreational use? Are there fishermen? Are there boats? Are there swimmers?
Are there fish?
So there's the beneficial uses part here, and that ties directly into these water quality standards that you're going to have to meet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of my economic things is that companies need to pay for the full price of their, they need to bear the full burden of the cost mm-hmm. of producing their product. Uh-huh. And so my instinct, even though I'm not very sophisticated about the business part of it, would be that the profile of the water coming into this enterprise mm-hmm. needs to match the profile of the water coming out of it.
Well,
I mean, that's a philosophical point of view, right?
I hear you.
Whether or not it actually ends up that way. And from an economic point of view.
That would be lovely.
Right. But from an economic point of view, we have to move that way. And expect companies to pay the full price.
But then they simply add it to the selling price of the product, so the customer pays for it.
And which means that if, because I end up paying for it in my taxes, if they don't anyway, because then I've got to clean up the mess, right? So if the company has a product that's not sustainable, it's too expensive to produce, I won't buy it, the product doesn't exist, and neither does the pollution.
Okay.
Well, I get it, but see, philosophically, that's where I'm
going.
Any other ideas about here? How you're gonna, what kind of policies you're gonna put in place? How are you gonna enforce this?
Thugs.
Monitoring. Okay, so monitoring is an important part.
And then there has to be teeth in the regulations, yeah. So that when
they don't.
Yeah, when they don't abide by
okay.
water quality standards, there are consequences.
Yeah, penalties. So how regularly do you think you need to do this monitoring thing to make sure that it goes well?
Daily, but, you know.
At least monthly, and then be subjected to irregular. I mean, anybody can come in at any time and check it.
Yeah, I don't think I would be happy personally if it was anything less than daily, or anything longer than daily
right.
monitoring, because, mm-hmm. you know, you could time things too well.
Yeah.
So monitoring, who does the monitoring? Are you content to let the factory do the monitoring, or are you content you're going to do it yourself?
Multiple, let's not say just one source, but multiple sources.
So probably
independent sources, because sources can be bought.
So probably mostly the factory, and with self-reporting. But then you're also going to go in there and you're going to get in some random testing. Just to make sure that they're you know, your tests, what you're measuring matches up with what they're measuring. And that's all kind of stuff that you're going to put in place. Anything else that you want in this, in your regulatory stuff?
Seeing that redundancy in their own treatment so that, you know, to know that they can handle sort of the ups and downs of one of our pieces of our treatment has gone down.
Contingency plans.
Redundancy or, I guess, overkill in their cleanup.
So I assume built into the water quality standards, you sort of need to know what are the repercussions of an accident. Because accidents happen,
mm-hmm.
you know. With a cheese factory, you get a little accident, and how, you know, presumably those
so, you know, it's, you know, you're at an advantage here, and when you get this situation where this plant is going in, you can put all these safeguards in place, and you can get the monitoring in front of time and kind of look at all the worst-case scenarios. Well, that works really well for anything that went in from 1972 and on, when the Clean Water Act went in place. How would you handle a situation where you have this big, massive, contaminated area before that you have to deal with? Like Holden Village mine site, for instance, from a water quality perspective there. I mean, you know, this was in there before the Clean Water Act. You know, you didn't have any of these safeguards in place that you're thinking about right now. It all just sort of happened. It's there now. What do you do?
So that's nothing.
Nothing for a long time. I mean, they're doing the mine remediation now, but that was 40 years ago that the Clean Water Act.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking of a point you made yesterday about things working on ecological timescales that humans don't have the patience for.
Right.
They're expecting much more immediate results in the cleanup itself, even if that means human intervention to achieve that, whereas eventually Mother Nature will take care of herself.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting situation. There's a lot of cases right now where there's bad contamination that's in sediments, but the sediments have been buried by other layers of sediments, and so even though those contaminants are still there and they're dangerous, it actually causes more of a problem to try to dig it up and clean it up than just to leave it alone and let it be. And there, I mean, there's a lot of argument that that's the situation with these tailings right now, that at this point maybe we should just leave them alone and not even mess with it. Perspective too, but so this, I guess, the third part that we're looking at then, besides stakeholders and the science, is the policy. Science can tell you, it can give you all sorts of information about the effects of the contaminants, but policy really needs to make the decisions about what concentrations are set and how to enforce things. Science can tell you how to clean something up and how much it costs, but policy people are the ones who are going to have to make the decision about whether it's worth the cost. They'll have to do some sort of a cost-benefit analysis and decide whether to pull it off. So science can give you answers, but science doesn't tell you what to do. That's where the policy comes in. So that's kind of the third plank of this water quality issue. And then the fourth one is that I focus in on with these, how this stuff gets portrayed, are the institutions. So who's doing all the work? What are the institutions that are involved? So what are the institutions that you're aware of in terms of any kind of water quality stuff, environmental stuff that come into play?
Looks like you mean like there's the EPA?
There is the EPA. So the EPA is the primary enforcement thing. So they are the primary enforcers. Clean Water Act. And sued enough. Well, just for you, I put that in.
So are we using the Clean Water Act as the filter? Because there are going to be various state agencies as well.
Well, the Clean Water Act is the one that sets the bar, but yeah, the EPA, well, the EPA gets broken down into regional levels, and then under each state, the state has an EPA as well. So, you know, in California, there's a California EPA, and they're the ones who are in charge of everything that's happening in California. So, I mean, it's all happening under the umbrella of the federal EPA, but it all gets filtered down into these state EPAs and then these regional water quality control boards.
And some of the states have higher water quality standards than...
Yes, so states can set their own standards too. So yeah, in California we've got the Port of Cologne Act, which sets higher standards than the EPA does for many things.
So are EPA people scientists or business people, or what would be their background to get hired and work for the EPA?
Well, I mean, there are scientists within the EPA too, but there are also people who are kind of more policy oriented folks who come into play as well.
The EPA is in charge of enforcing their own standard quality standards, but then a state puts in higher quality standards. Who enforces the higher ones?
I think probably the state EPA does.
Oh, they'll step up even though it's not their own?
Yeah, I believe so.
Washington Department of Ecology. This is from the meeting yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Washington State Department of Ecology.
Okay,
that's
yeah.
This location.
So there are a lot. There are several different state state organizations, state options that will come into play in water quality. It's not just the EPA. What about groundwater? Who takes care of it?
Municipal government?
Yeah, municipal government. So the key thing with the Clean Water Act is that this is only for surface water, surface navigable water. So for groundwater,
navigable, that would exclude, you know, potholes and things like that.
Yeah, presumably. I mean, I'm not exactly how you know. I mean, you could put. I don't know how small the boat has to be, or you consider it to be unnavigable. But groundwater is not actually covered. This is actually covered by Safe Drinking Water Act. So groundwater is really under the jurisdiction of the FDA, not the EPA, because it's not considered, it's not a navigable water. So the FDA is the one who has to take care of the groundwater, is the primary piece of, and it's clunky. Mm-hmm. It's there used to be a time when groundwater was considered to just be completely sterile and abiotic, and there was no ecological significance associated with it at all, and so that's how it ended up in this, just under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And it's not sufficient anymore, but you know, there's so many different issues now with property rights and land use rights and mineral rights and all sorts of things too, that it's hard to imagine what it's going to take for this to get kind of put under the umbrella of something more like the Clean Water Act. I mean, we may be getting toward the tipping point here in California in the near future, now that we're starting to realize how, you know, you can pollute groundwater 50 miles away from you, but there's these boundary issues that are starting to dissolve, and you know, that at some point it's gonna happen. I think that it has to happen just because there's so much fluidity between the different places. Any other kinds of institutions?
Well, just as a last point, from a scientific perspective,
mm-hmm.
the EPA and the FDA, completely different areas of expertise for the individuals involved.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a disconnect there that needs to happen. I mean, if there's hydrologic connectivity between the surface water and the groundwater, that sort of will still fall under the umbrella of the Clean Water Act too, but there's a lot of aquifers. That's hard to establish. Another one that's pretty big in the water quality world is USGS, U.S. Geological Survey. They do a lot of the monitoring work. They have stations in rivers all over the U.S. that are just taking regular water data, regular water quality data.
Things like Greenpeace or Sierra Club or both?
Yeah, you can, sure. Yeah, any of those things
too.
So NGOs,
yeah.
Universities.
And probably Congress, or, you know, they're the ones voting on the Clean Water Act.
Jeez. For research. Yeah, I mean, there's a whole host of institutions that you can put into play too, but, you know, so that's the fourth thing that I focus in on when we're looking at water quality. So it's just, who's the stakeholder, and you got to know who it is you're trying to deal with, what does the science say about it, what kind of policy is in place, and then institutions, who's doing the work. And that's sort of the four-point framework that I try to hammer home on all the water quality stuff, and you won't get much of this, or you'll get some of this, but you won't get all of this. There's a lot of holes in what gets portrayed in the media too, but anyway. That's all I have, unless you have any parting shots before we head off to lunch. Yeah.
Do you use a filter on your home water system?
Why? No. Yeah.
What is your perception of the bottled water industry?
Well, I'm going to be talking about that next week, but
we'll be gone soon.
Yeah, the bottled water act industry. There is a small place for it in situations where there are genuine water quality concerns in third world countries and things like that. I think it's just one of the biggest scams out there right now. I cannot believe how much, how hard it's marketed, how easily people buy into it.
Yes.
What does that say then to the question you asked us yesterday?
About
human values being compatible with environmental sustainability.
Well, that one I would say not. it appalls me that my department still brings in, I'm in the Department of Land, Air, and Water Resources on the number one environmental research campus in the country, and we bring bottled water into, or you know, they bring bottled water into our department, and it just drives me nuts, and I can't understand where that's coming from, and you know, so, and why our campus wouldn't be out front leading the way.
Well, who put that policy in place?
It's just one of those things. It was there when I got there, so it's not something that's happened since I've been there. It was, you know, they were already doing it. But a lot of it comes down to, I don't know, some people were talking about the taste and the aesthetics of drinking water, and the marketing on that is pretty hard. They really push hard on that, but 70% of bottled water comes straight out of the tap, out of your municipal water district. They just take it and they just, you know, filter it, maybe stick it in a bottle and sell it to you at 200 times the price. It's the greatest money-making scheme that I've heard in a while.
Have you seen Tapped?
Yes.
Yes.
Nice name on the guys. Wow.
Anyway, so that's next week.
Next week and look for bottled air.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you. Thank you.